happy to be here. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of background. I've been working as a researcher in Bar-Ilan in artificial intelligence for decades already, and some of the work I did years ago was on authorship analysis. There's lots of different kinds of problems with authorship analysis, but for the past 5-6 years, I've been running a lab in Yerushalayim that is dedicated to bringing artificial intelligence, AI, to the study of Torah. There are many different applications. So let me first give you a broad background of the kinds of things that AI can do for learning, things that are so far not available to people, but within the next year or two are actually going to be very, very widely available. And then after that, I'll talk specifically about one of the applications, which is authorship analysis and identifying forgeries, and I'll talk about some famous forgeries or not forgeries. I'm not going to give away the ending quite yet. That in Jewish literature in the 20th century. Okay, so first of all, what are the kinds of things you might want to do if you had all of the tools of AI at your disposal and you wanted to use it to facilitate learning Torah? So all of you are familiar with search engines for this purpose. The most famous, or the first one at least, is the Bar-Ilan Responsive Project, Project Hashut. Now, Project Hashut was developed originally in the 1960s, okay, so it goes way back, and it's a search engine. Most of the search tools that you have now on that were developed in the 1970s, and oddly enough, pretty much nothing has changed since then, okay? The search engine that you use today in Bar-Ilan is more or less the same search engine that you'd have used over 40 years ago. In that same software, which is really strange because lots and lots of things have happened in the field. So let's talk about some of the things some of the improvements you would like to see in that, okay? And I'll tell you what's possible and not possible and you know what's likely to happen very soon. So first of all, when I do a search, let's just take an example of the kind of thing I might search with. I might search about. Okay, supposing I'm studying Hilchos Shabbos and I'm learning about the malacha of mimareach. Right, mimareach is something like spreading or creating a new surface. And one of the common examples of mimareach on Shabbos is using a bar of soap. Okay, bars of soap are not quite as common as they used to be. Liquid non-soap is become more popular. But in any event, you're not supposed to use a bar of soap on Shabbos because it creates a new surface. It's a malacha mimareach. Okay. Now, supposing I was interested in researching this and I wanted to go to a search engine and find all of the main sources on this topic. All right? So what word or words would I put into the search engine for that purpose? I mean, where would you even begin? What would you stick in there? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mimareach Shabbos isn't bad. But let's say you were interested specifically in the question of soap, whether soap is mimareach or it isn't mimareach, right? I mean, that's a great start. That's where I would start too. But I'm specifically interested in the question of soap on Shabbos. So what would you put in there? Okay. So you might put in sabon, right? I mean, the problem is this. The word sabon is really a modern Hebrew word for soap. The Gemara talks about soap, and the Rishonim talk about soap, but they don't call it sabon. Okay? And most people don't actually know what the word is for soap. Okay, even people who are Talmidei Chacham don't necessarily know this word. The word is buris, okay, or burit, right? That's the word. So, for example, there's a tshuva in the Igros Moshe, right, which is ha'im utar l'shtamesh b'burit lach b'shabbat, right? He's talking about liquid soap. So he calls it burit lach. Nobody in the world would ever have thought of that phrase, right, burit lach, unless they were really holding in the sugya. Okay, so what I'd really like is the following. Okay, first of all, I would like to be able to put in mimareach Shabbat Sabon, because that's the word I know, and I would like the search engine, first of all, to understand that the word Sabon has an equivalent in rabbinic Hebrew, and that equivalent is Burit. Okay? The second thing I would like is, okay, now I'm going to get, if I put it into Bar-Ilan, or even if I put it into Google now, right, which is actually a pretty decent search engine for these purposes, right, I put in these words, I get out, what? I get out a bunch of places in which those words happen to be used in some proximity, right? But that's not really what I want, right? What I really want is places that are talking about this sugya, which may use these words, may use different words for that purpose. What I'm looking for is not these words, but I'm looking for the concepts, right? And I want a search engine that's going to actually find the concepts, okay? I also want this information organized in some reasonable way, right? What I don't want is to organize it according to some scoring function that these search engines have, where if it happens to say the word memareach 13 times in a paragraph, that's what I'm going to get, because you get points for every appearance of one of my query words, right? That's really a very, very inefficient way to present it. What I really like is something that structures the sugya for me, right? That says, look, the most important sources for the sugya that you're interested in are these. Now, how would that be done? If you think about it, there's lots of different tricks you could use. Okay, first of all, you need a thesaurus, and there are ways of automatically constructing cross-generational thesauries that actually could figure out that the word burit is used in rabbinic Hebrew in pretty much the same context as the word sabon is in modern Hebrew, and therefore automatically realizes that these are synonyms. Okay, but let's not get into that. That's kind of complicated. Let me give you a very simple algorithm for finding the most important sources, let's say Gemaras and Rishonim and so forth, on any sugya. Right, let's work with my example. Okay, say, here's what I would do. Okay, I would first just do a regular search, and I would discover, right, that there are a number of tshuvas, or a number of gemaras, or a number of rambams that are particularly pertinent to this thing, right? And they'll come up because they use the words, right? They use the words burit and memareach and shabbat. Okay, so I discovered that there's a tshuva of Rabbi Akiva Eger and a tshuva of the Chassam Sofer, and there's a particular rambam and a particular gemara. Now, okay, so I got some of the sources, but I got all kinds of stuff, and these are just kind of buried among them, and this really doesn't cover the sugya. Ah, but one second. Supposing now I did a second order search, and you could program the search engine to do this automatically. I would do a second order search that did the following. Could you find me a tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef, who quotes lots and lots of sources, right, in which many of the sources that I already found in my original search are quoted, right? So supposing I discover that in Yabia Omer, in Tshuva Reish Chaf Dalid, right, he quotes that Rabbi Akiva Eger, and he quotes exactly that Chassam Sofer, and he quotes exactly that Rambam and exactly that Gemara. So what do I know? I know that this is a tshuva of Rav Ovadia that must be about this topic, because he's citing all of these things that I know are relevant to the topic. Okay, supposing the engine was able to do that, and I found this tshuva of Rav Ovadia, what would be the next step that I would do? This is an obvious one, think. Okay, what I would do is, I would say, wait a minute. If I have this piece in Yabia Omer, where he quotes exactly those tshuvas and that Rambam and that Gemara, and I know it's about the topic, well, who else does he quote there? He must quote a bunch of other tshuvas as well, and a bunch of other Gemaras as well, and a bunch of other Rambams as well. Those are probably all relevant, right? And it may be that I didn't find any of those because they don't happen to use the words. But I know they're relevant because Rav Ovadia quotes them together with other tshuvas that I know are relevant, right? So that's the kind of game you can... Now, everything that I just described to you can be done programmatically. There's nothing that I just told you that you need a human being to sit there and... This can all be done programmatically, okay? You just need to know that Rav Ovadia is quoting these Gemaras and these things, and that itself is not trivial, but it can be automated, okay? So this is a way, right, in which some of the new AI algorithms could vastly improve the way a search engine works. But we could do a lot more than that. When the sources are presented to you, right, you want them to be easy to read, right? So what about putting in the vocalization, right, the nikud into, right? I'm going to learn a tshuva now because I discovered it's relevant to what I'm searching. Why can't I have nikud in there? Why can't I have punctuation in there? Why can't all of the Rashei Tevot, some of which are very ambiguous and hard to figure out, why can't they all be opened automatically, right? Now, none of this is trivial, but it can be done, because you can figure out, just like we, when we read it, can figure out from the context what the most likely opening of those abbreviations are. Is it Amar Avraham or E.F. Shar or Ani Omer, or right? I mean, you could figure it out from context. Well, there are now programs that can analyze syntax and morphology and just in general all the properties of a text in order to figure out what is the most likely expansion of a particular abbreviation. What is the right nikud, right? If you take a word, almost any string of letters in Hebrew has multiple possible ways of putting in the nikud, but from the context you can usually figure out what it is, and you can have a program do that, okay? Now, you could also do things that are That's the kind of thing, right? Putting in punctuation or nikud or opening abbreviations are mostly for people who are not experts. But even experts can benefit from these kinds of programs. Let me give you an example. When you're learning a text, there are often mistakes in the text, right? And those mistakes come either from a taut sofer, the person who originally wrote the manuscript made a mistake, the person who copied the manuscript made the mistake. Then after that, at some point, it got typed in by a printer. The person who typed it in made mistakes. And then usually these things go into programs that we now use because they were scanned, right? And then some kind of OCR technology was used in order to turn them into a text file, right? Instead of just a picture file. Now, those OCR things make mistakes. A dalet and a resh look very similar. A tav and a ches look very similar, right? They make mistakes. Now, what I'd really like is some kind of an algorithm that is able to take a text, go over it, and just because using the context, right, because it's seen 500 million words already, it knows that, oh, that can't be a Zion, that has to be a Vav, that can't be a Ches, that has to be a Taf, right? It should be able to self-correct based on principles of the language that it's already internalized based on seeing hundreds of millions of words, okay? And this is the kind of thing that we could already do. You could also take multiple versions of the same text, right? Because you have different kisveyad and different printed versions of the same text. What you need to do is find some smart algorithm that knows how to align these things so that the parallel words are in the same column, and then uses some clever algorithms for figuring out which of the different choices in that column, which are the different versions for, right, that word, which is most likely the correct one, based on figuring out which is the most reliable manuscript version or which makes the most sense linguistically and all that. And you can actually cleanse a text of mistakes this way, right? You'd also like to be able to automatically footnote a book. Supposing I now have, I'm putting out a new version of the Tshuvas of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, right? Now, Rabbi Akiva Eiger quotes earlier Tshuvas, and he quotes Gemaras, and he quotes Rambams, and he quotes Rishonim, right? He's quoting all these people all the time. But he doesn't necessarily tell you exactly where these things are from. Wouldn't it be nice if I could just take a book like that, or any other book, a book that I'm writing, right? Any book, or a book that I just happen to have handy, but in digital form, put it into a program, and the program would simply scan it and say, oh, that's a Yerushalmi in Peah, okay? And that's a Rambam in Hilchas Melachim. And that is a Ritva in Kiddushin, right? And just simply go through the entire book and footnote the entire book, every single place where there's a quote or even a paraphrase that's close enough to a quote, simply identify it and mark it for you. So essentially it would be footnoting the entire book. That would really make life easier for us, right? We'd be able to track down all the sources we're learning about, just immediately track it down. Nowadays, this is done manually, right? You see all these nice modern versions of a book. What do? They look at different versions, and they figure out where there are mistakes, and they correct them. And they try to track down all the sources and put in footnotes and tell you where they're from, right? But all of that, I mean, that it takes a scholar years in order to put out one book like that. Imagine if you had a program that would just do it in a few seconds to any book that you put in there. Now, that's not science fiction. That's something that already exists in my lab, sort of, and will probably be available already now. It is available. If you go to dicta.org.il, you could put in any book, and it will point out every single Gemara and every single Pasuk that's quoted in there. As it develops further, within a year or two, you should be able to get any book at all that exists in digital form, and it'll tell you, I've identified it. Okay, this comes from here, this comes from here, this comes from there. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you'd like. Now, in this last category, right, of things that are of interest to scholars, there's one other thing that would actually be very interesting, and that is, given a particular book for which the authorship is either in doubt or completely unknown, could we identify the author of the book? Right? So there are many different ways. There are many different ways that you could do that. I mean, if in most cases we know who the author is. Okay, there are some cases where we think we know and we're wrong, but in most cases we know. But there are very many cases where we don't know. Today I'll talk about two of them, and we'll see who actually wrote the book or who didn't write the book. Okay, so these kinds of authorship problems. You can, by the way, jump in anytime with questions. Feel free. Okay, these kind of authorship questions really divide up into several different kinds of questions. One of them is, okay, typical example that comes up all the time. We have the Chuvas HaRashba and the Chuvas HaRitva. The Rashba and the Ritva were both students of the Ramban. They lived around the same time in Spain, similar styles, and they're often confused with each other for various reasons. If you look in the Beit Yosef, right, in his parish on the tour, he often quotes the Chuvas of the Rashba and the Ritva. Every once in a while, he'll say, right, v'chein kasav haritva b'tshuva. But if you look it up in the books that we have available, it wasn't the Ritva who, or at least, you know, we don't have it among the writings of the Ritva. We have it among the writings of the Rashba. So now the question is, okay, so who made a mistake here? Did the Beit Yosef make a mistake and he kind of just got confused between the Ritva and the Rashba and he didn't look it up? Or maybe our books, you know, when the books, you know, they collected tshuvas, maybe when they collected the tshuvas in order to print them, they actually made mistakes, right? And they kind of found the tshuva. They thought it was written by the Ritva, but in fact it was the Rashba, vice versa. So in some cases then, we have particular tshuvas and we don't know who wrote them, okay? So that is called, a case like that is a classic case of authorship attribution. We have two or maybe several possible authors, and we want to know which of them is the author. That's the easiest kind of attribution problem that there is, because, well, we more or less know how we would solve them, okay? And I'll tell you what the trick is. The trick is pretty straightforward. I say, all right, we have thousands of tshuvas by the Ritva, we have thousands of tshuvas by the Rashba, right? Let's compare them, all right? Let's just have a computer go through them and look at the frequency of every single word, right? With what frequency does it appear in the Ritva's writing? With what frequency does it appear in the Rashba's writing? And now we kind of know, is that a Ritva word or a Rashba word? And you can use some very clever mathematics, which I'm not going to get into, but the point is, you could give every word a weight, okay? So you say, oh, if the word ka'asher, which is used six times more by the Rashba than by the Ritva, right? The word ka'asher gets 17 points in favor of the Ritva, right? And the word im gets 12 points in favor of the Rashba, and right, we can do this for all the points. Now these points, you know, I'm not going like that. There's a formula for how you do it. And then in the end, basically, you know, once you've used all the known tshuvas of the Ritva and the Rashba in order to give points to each word, now you take this new tshuva and you're not quite sure if it's the Rashba and the Ritva, and what do? Well, you look at what are the words that actually appear in it, right? And you give points. You say, well, see, it's got a lot of Rashba words here. It doesn't have too many Ritva words. Let's add up the score. Well, it gets, you know, lots of Rashba points, so I'm pretty confident that this is written by the Rashba. That's a more or less simplistic way of describing it. It's not necessarily a point system. There are algorithms that are actually considerably more sophisticated than that. You don't necessarily want to use only words. You might want to use morphological structures, right? You might want to use syntactic structures. You might want to use phrases. There are all different kinds of things you might want to use. I could just tell you a trick, you know, being in the field for many years, that most of the bang for your buck you get from words, okay? Really, word frequencies is where the action is. The other stuff is kind of nice, but it's a bonus. It's not the main thing, okay? And some of these things are hard to measure. You know, trying to figure out how many times you use a particular morphological structure entails, you know, doing a real deep analysis of the language, and that might be different. Counting words is the easiest thing in the world, right? It takes a second. So that's one kind of problem. There's another one that's very similar, which is, you know what, I don't know who the candidate authors are. I just found this manuscript. Imagine that you found the manuscript, right? So you don't know that it was either the Rashba or the Ritva. It could be anybody. You don't know when it was written. You don't know where it was written. You really don't know anything at all, right? So what would you do in such a case? So in such a case, what you would do is something like these, you know, psychological experts that they bring on these, you know, TV police shows, right? Come in and say, oh yeah, it's got to be a 43-year-old Bulgarian house painter, right? Based on something, right? So that's the kind of thing that you'd like to do. You want to, you know, if you look at texts that were written in the 13th century, 14th century, 15th century, and so forth, you see the language evolves and the styles are actually different. So one of the things you might want to do is say, okay, first of all, when was it written based on the style, based on the word usage and things like that? And it's very interesting that there are certain words, we've tracked it down basically for every word in rabbinic Hebrew. When does it first start getting used, right? There are words that don't appear in the Gemara, they only appear in the Rishonim, right? And then there are words that only appear, you know, in the later Rishonim, only in the Achronim, only appear in the 20th century, right? So for example, if you see, like, here's a word that you'll see, you know, quite often in modern Jewry, right? The word dollar, right? Right? Dollar. Or minayot. Or, right? Internet, to take an extreme example, where you don't see very often in Jewry, but you see it sometimes nowadays, right? So if you see these words, well, you can more or less say, well, they were written at least after those words started getting used, okay? This is a little bit, you can be fooled by this. I'll give you an example. The word chashmal. You would imagine that the word chashmal, electricity, is a word that only started getting used in around the 1890s or so, because electricity came into common use in the 1880s. Tshuva started being written in the 1890s. The Beis Yitzchak being the first tshuva that was written about electricity in 1895. And so you'd say, wow. So if I see the word chashmal, I know that's probably a 20th century tshuva, no earlier than that, except there's one problem, right? Which is the word chashmal in the first place comes from Yechezkel, okay? The word, so you might find, so you could be fooled. Now, okay, you could say, well, forget about Yechezkel. If it's Yechezkel, I'll recognize it as Yechezkel. If it's not Yechezkel, then it's probably 20th century. Well, not exactly, because it turns out that there are many mefarshim that wrote about Yechezkel and cited Yechezkel and so forth. So you actually see the word chashmal appearing from biblical times until today fairly consistently. Okay, there's a big jump in the 20th century. But so that's not a, right, you can't use a single word as a proof. But what you could do is you could profile a tshuva in terms of its language and see whether this style is later or earlier. And if it uses lots of modern words, then you'll know, right? Okay, so That is called profiling, right? You could use profiling not only to date a tshuva, you could use profiling also to tell you where a tshuva was written. If you look, or any book, right? A book that was written in France or Germany will not use the same kind of rabbinic Hebrew as a book that was written in Spain or Portugal, right? The Hebrew is going to be subtly different, right? Even in, you know, 13th, 14th century, You'll see subtle differences between them, but they're so subtle that you wouldn't see it yourselves. It's not like you could open it up and say, "Aha! Of course, this is Spanish, right?" But a computer is able to find these differences. Okay, and then finally, the most difficult kind of authorship attribution problem that you might want to consider is something called verification. Right, what verification is. I want to know whether a particular text was written by a particular person or not. Okay? Now, so for example, right, we're going to talk, if there's time, we'll talk about a particular example of a book that may or may not have been written by the Ben Ishchai. The Ben Ishchai lived at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century in Iraq. And he wrote 33 books, and one of his books, which we'll discuss, called Torah Lishma, is of unclear authorship. Okay, it's not clear whether he wrote it or he didn't write it. He said that he found it, not that he wrote it. Now, there, it's not as if the question is, was it written by the Ben Ishchai or by his friend, somebody else, right? The question is, was it written by the Ben Ishchai or not? Now, as you can see, that's a harder problem than was it written by the Rashba or the Ritva? Because if the question is, was it written by the Rashba or the Ritva, what do? I just compare the Rashba to the Ritva. But if the question is, was it written by the Ben Ishchai or somebody else in the world, right? So I don't have something to compare it to, right? So we need to be a lot more clever about that, and we'll get to that. There are actually methods for doing it. Okay, but let's start now with, I want to cover for the rest of the time I have, which is how much? Okay. I want to cover two real-world forgery problems. Okay, the question is, are these forgeries or are they not forgeries? Right? And they were very, very important at the time, and they're actually still argued about today, both of these. They're both controversial. And we're just going to solve them together. Okay? I'm going to give an answer to both of these. Okay, so the first one is something called Gnizat Kherson. Here's the story. Okay? It's the time of the Russian Revolution, and things are changing, all kinds of stuff that wasn't available before under the Tsar suddenly becomes available due not to the kindness of the revolutionaries, the Russian Revolution, but because of general chaos and things suddenly that were under lock and key become accessible to people. So this fellow, right after the revolution, says that he was in a police station in St. Petersburg, and he managed to extract from there a trove of writings, and these writings are, in fact, letters that were signed by the very earliest Hasidic Rebbes. Okay, so we're talking about starting right from the Baal Shem Tov. There's a whole bunch of letters in this trove that are actually signed by the Baal Shem Tov himself. There are many that are signed by the Baal HaTanya, that's the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And there are a variety of letters there. There's about 60, 70 letters in all that are written by various very, very famous early Hasidic Rebbes. Now, if in fact these letters are authentic, they're priceless, okay? Because we have only one letter that we know of from the Baal Shem Tov. We have a bunch from the Baal HaTanya, but these are extremely, extremely, extremely rare, extremely, extremely valuable if they are indeed authentic. So these letters were taken to various authorities to determine whether or not they're authentic. Okay, so first they were taken to the Gerer Rebbe. Okay, so this was the late 19 teens. So the Gerer Rebbe at the time is the Imre Emes of Ram Mordechai Migur. And he takes these letters and he looks at them and he shows them also to Rav Meir Dan Plonsky, who was one of the famous Gedolim at the time. He wrote a sefer called Kli Chemda, which is still learned today. And the two of them looked over these letters together and they declared that they were mizuyaf, forgeries, right? So they were forgery, mizuyaf. Okay, so in Poland, the Gerer Rebbe and the Kli Chemda, what they say goes, forgeries. However, these letters were also shown to the Lubavitcher Rebbe at the time. The Lubavitcher Rebbe at the time, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Yosef Yitzchak, the Rayatz. And the Rayatz looks at these letters and he says, Kodesh Kadashim. Okay, those are his exact words. He says, Kodesh Kadashim. Okay, so now we have the clash of the titans, okay? So the Gerer Rebbe says they're Mizuyaf, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says they're Kodesh Kadashim. So what are they? Okay, so people have been arguing about this for the past, it's now 100 years. So they've been arguing about this for 100 years now. Are these real or are they not real? Okay, so these letters were brought to me by not the actual letters, but the digitized form. In other words, I got the actual texts of all of these letters from my friend Professor Shlomo Zalman Havlin, who's in the Talmud department at Bar Ilan, who is from a Lubavitcher family. I'm from a Gerer family, and he brought me these letters, and he told me that his personal opinion is, as a Lubavitcher, that they're actually forgeries. Okay, so he disagreed with with the Rayatz. He said that he thinks they're forgeries, but he wants me to do a statistical analysis and see if we could figure out whether the letters are forgeries or not. Okay, so the trick here is figuring out a methodology, right? How are you going to do this? So remember what we have available to us. What we have available to us is a whole bunch of letters that we know were written by the Balatanya. Okay, I've got in electronic form a bunch of letters that were written and signed by the Balatanya, and that the authenticity of which has never been doubted. Okay, so I've got that. So now the question is, given that, how can I set up a problem over here so that it's in a nice, easy form to figure out whether it's authentic or not? Okay, so here's the trick. Okay, once you get the methodology right, then actually implementing it is really pretty straightforward. Here's the trick. I have three sets of documents. Okay, I'll show you how I have three sets. First of all, I have here genuine Balatanya letters. Okay, those I've got. Okay, now in the letters in the what's called the Gnizat Cherson, okay, I'm going to divide them up into two parts. Those that are signed by the Balatanya, which is about half of them, okay, and those that are signed by other people. Okay, now, let's take the real Balatanya letters and put them over here. Okay, this is the real Balatanya letters. Let's take all the letters that are in this trove that are signed by other people, not the Balatanya, right? And let's put them over here. Okay, now, here's the thing. When I take the letters that are in this trove that are signed by the Balatanya, right? Well, to which side should they be more similar, right? Well, let's think about it. If these letters are authentic, then let's put here these letters signed by the Balatanya, right? Signed by the Balatanya. I'm going to call these real Balatanya, I'm going to call these signed by Balatanya, and I'm going to call these signed by other people, okay? The signed by Balatanya, if they're authentic, should be more similar to the ones that are Balatanya. But the signed Balatanya, if they're forgeries, and let's assume, as is reasonable, that if they're forgeries, they were all forged by the same person, right? Well, in that case, if they're forgeries, the ones that are signed by Balatanya should be more similar to the ones that are signed by other people, because they're all in the same trove, presumably all forged by the same person if they were forged, right? So that becomes the game. So, step one, then, is to take the signed by other people and the actually by Balatanya and run a program on them that kind of builds a model that's able to distinguish between them. Okay? Now, look at these. Not at the top one, right? Look at, first of all, at the side that begins with Mikhtav Begnizat Kherson HaMiyuchas L'Rosh HaMilati, okay? Ignore the first one, okay? That's the one we want to figure out which side it goes to. Look at the second one. A genuine letter by Rav Shlomo Zalman Miladi, right? By the Balatanya, okay? So note, okay, that he refers, for example, to a person. He says, Mipi Adonenu Harav HaKadosh HaKohen HaGadol SheYichya, right? Okay. Now, what you don't see there is a whole bunch of honorifics next to the name, okay? He just has a very modest sheyichya at the end, right? Harav HaKadosh, that's kind of pretty parvus stuff. That's like standard, like mister in rabbinic writing, okay? Standard stuff, okay? So, but if you look at another letter, right, you look at a letter, the third one, that comes from Gnizat Cherson, that is attributed to the Baal Shem Tov, right? So it's signed by the Baal Shem Tov, the third one that you have over here, right? So how does it begin? El Kvod Kodesh Yedid Hashem V'Yedid Nafshi Yishalakim Arav Agon HaKadar Sar HaTayra Chavri Talmidi Uben Gili V'chulim Arenu Arav Dov Ber Yichya Netzach Yud Nun is Yichya Netzach Mi Mezrich Kvod Kachay, right, etc., etc. Lots and lots of honorifics going to them. All right. Now, this is, in general, a pattern that one finds. Okay? I want you to note one other thing. Look in the, back to the second letter, the one that's, right, a real Rav Shlomo Zalman Miladi letter. Look at the very last word. What's the last word that you see there? Chuli. Right? How is that different than what we're accustomed to seeing? What would you have expected to see over there? You'd have expected to see vichule, right? Vav, chav, vav, right? Usually when somebody finishes a pasuk in the middle, or a saying, they write vichu, right? Vichule, right? Or vegomer sometimes, right? Now, what you see here is that he leaves off the vav. He writes kuli, but he does not write vichuli. As it turns out, that is consistent throughout the writings of the Bala Tanya. He always says chuli, he doesn't say vichuli. It's kind of a more archaic way of saying vichuli. Okay, now that we know all this, we know that Rosh Shlomo Zalman Milady, in fact, uses very few honorifics, does not use Kocho, Yichya Netzach, all of those wonderful things, and that he says chuli and not vichuli, right? And we see that in the letters signed by the Baal Shem Tov, we see that what? That he uses Yichya Netzach, he uses Kvod Kocho multiple times, and he writes vichuli. Okay. Says these are the kinds of things, right? The computer picks these things up very, very quickly. And then when it analyzes the letters, now go to the top one, Mifto Bignizat Chersonim Yuchas L'Rishon Mizamadan, that's the one that's sitting here in the middle, right? And what do you see? Okay? He's using Kvod Kocho, he's using Yichya Netzach, he's using Vichule, right? All of these things we already understand are not typical of Rav Shlomo Zalman Milady. He did not write that way. He didn't use the word Vichule, he didn't use the word Yichya Netzach, he didn't use the word Kvod Kocho, never, okay? So, in fact, what the computer spits out is that this letter is much more similar to the other letters in the trove, right, the one signed by the Baal Shem Tov, and in fact, all 25 letters that are attributed to Shlomo Zalman Milady are more similar to the other letters in the trove than to his authentic writing. So we can conclude without doubt that all the letters in this trove are complete forgeries. Okay, indeed they are forgeries. Okay, okay. So that's problem number one, and that turns out to be pretty straightforward. Okay. Once you set it up right, it's pretty straightforward. That one's a complete fake. Okay. Now let's talk. I should just tell you some postscripts to this. Okay. So some postscripts are that the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rayatz, had said they were Kodesh Kodashim. Right. As a result, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, right, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, right, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he, being loyal to his father-in-law, when asked about it, said, Kodesh Kedoshim, right? He was not going to argue with his father-in-law. So then people came to him and said, but they did a chemical analysis of the ink and the paper on these letters, and the ink and the paper were both 20th century ink and paper. They were not, right? I mean, if the Baal Shem Tov wrote it, this would be in the 18th century, right? They were not 18th century ink and paper. So how could that be? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe cleverly answered, well, Kodesh Kedoshim refers to the text, not to the paper and the ink. The paper, and in fact, these letters were copied over in the 20th century. They were copied from the original text. They were copied. And therefore, the texts themselves are holy, but you know the paper and the ink are later. That's perfectly okay. So that worked for the paper and the ink, but it does not work for the words. Okay, so I'm pretty convinced that at this point he would throw in the towel. But anyway, all right. So now let's move. Yeah.
Would there be a way to focus on content of the letters? In other words, are there themes or Kabbalistic notions
yeah.
that are taken for granted that whereas a Tanya does or doesn't?
Right. So you could try to do that, and some of that is captured by analyzing the words, right? So if some of the words are different, but if you're talking about not things that are captured by the words, but actually like. You need to understand what their shita was, and that you still need a human expert to do that. In other words, but the computer would find it very hard to do that. But yes, people still do that. And as a matter of fact, the problem that we're now going to talk about that's exactly what people have been doing. So we'll see. So you're absolutely right about that. Okay. So turn over the page, and we're going to tell you the great mystery of the Ben Ish Chai. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the Ben Ish Chai was the chief rabbi, posek, Talmud Chacham of the community of Baghdad in Iraq. He was a very, very colorful and famous figure. He wrote 33 books. people, you know, tell me stories. Their, you know, grandparents remembered seeing him, right? He died in 1908. So there are still people alive today who heard stories from their grandparents about him. He didn't have a microphone, and he would speak to thousands of people, and, you know, he had such a booming voice that people would hear him very, very far away. He was a very, very interesting fellow. He wrote on Kabbalah, he wrote on Tanakh, he wrote on Medrash, he wrote on Halacha, he wrote on everything, okay? So his most famous work is the Ben Ishkai, which is a work of Halacha, which is, you know, kind of like the Mishnah Brura of Iraqi Jews. Okay, so the story is as follows. He put out a book of tshuvas of his own, which is called Rav Pa'alim. Many, many tshuvas, over 500 tshuvas. He also published another book of tshuvas called Torah Lishma. And Torah Lishma also has many hundreds of tshuvas, but when he put out the book, he said, "This is not my work, this is a work that I found, and it's a very valuable work. And if you look at the very first tshuva in the book, which I have here, on top of the page, it begins with a kind of introduction to the work. And the introduction goes as follows. Amar hakatan Yechezkel kachli, be'ezrat el tzirivigo ali, hinei zeh hecheli, mishnat hei taf mem bet. We'll get back to that. Lichtov seder shelot u'tshuvot, mima shechaneni el shochen aravot." And then he goes into the first tshuva, which is, about talis and tefillin, and what happens if you had your tefillin before you had your talis, and, you know, what order should you put them on in, you know, that kind of thing. Okay. Anyway, first of all, who is the author of this book? It's right here. What's the name of the author of the book?
Yechezkel
Kachli. Okay. Now, what year was the book written? When did he begin writing the book, at least? Okay? It says, Hey Taf Mem Bet, simple calculation, the year is 1682. Okay? Now, bear in mind that 1682, okay, is 150 years before the birth of the Ben Ish Chai. Okay? So we have two reasons to believe that this is not the Ben Ish Chai. First of all, the author's name is Yechezkel Kachli. The Ben Ish Chai's name was Yosef Chaim. Secondly, the year in which he started writing it is 150 years before the Ben Ish Chai was born. Okay, so those are two very good reasons to believe that the Ben Ish Chai is not the author of this book. And you would think that that would be decisive. Okay, but in fact, there's a problem with this. And the problem is very straightforward. Okay. The problem is that until the Ben Ish Chai published this work, which he found in the Gniza in Baghdad, nobody had ever heard of somebody called Yechezkel Kachli. Nobody had ever seen any of these tshuvas. Now, that seems to be peculiar. I'll tell you why it's peculiar, okay? If somebody wrote 500 tshuvas, that means that he got asked 500 questions, right? If he got asked 500 questions, that means at the very least he's famous, right? I mean, somebody famous enough that got asked 500 questions, right, is famous, right? So it's not like somebody could have produced the Igris Moshe, right, out of the blue and say, I don't know, some guy, Moshe Feinstein, never heard of him, right? That would be an unlikely turn of events, okay? But this is exactly what happened here. He, right, the Ben Ish Chai produced a book written by Yechezkel Kachli, literally, never heard of the guy. Nobody ever heard of the guy. Okay. 500. Okay. Seems unlikely. Okay. Now, so the obvious suspect, if in fact there was no person named Yechezkel Kachli, is that, well, who else could have written it, right? Nobody else saw it until the Ben Ish Chai, so it must be the Ben Ish Chai, right? So, the question was raised, was the Ben Ish Chai, in fact, the actual author of this book? Okay. Well, let's look at some of the evidence we have. First of all, note that in Tshuva's Rav Pa'alim, right, this is the very second Tshuva in the book that I'm bringing you, the second one here, which everybody agrees was written by the Ben Ish Chai, right? Everybody agrees. Well, he Right there in the second Shuva says, V'chein ra'isi l'mahari kachli, right, that's where Yechezkel kachli zal, b'sefer Torah l'shma, k'sav yad, sh'nishal, okay, so he's quoting him, right? So the fact that he's quoting him would suggest further that Yechezkel kachli is a real person. It would be really, really bizarre, right, if the Ben Ish Chai had actually written this book and then in other places would write, oh, and by the way, you know, it's not just me, right? Yechezkel Kachli also wrote this, okay? That's already getting quite bizarre. Okay, well now, let's look at some reasons to believe that, in fact, Yechezkel Kachli is not the Ben Ish Chai. So the first is, look at the very last line of the first Shuva, the one written by Yechezkel Kachli, and it's V'heyeze Shalom, right, etc., etc., etc. That's his sign-off. Now, if you look at all the Shuvas in the Torah Lishma, basically all of them end with this sign-off, right? He says, you know, V'yeze Shalom, etc., etc. That's, you know, like his sincerely yours, okay? Now, if you look in Rav Pa'olim, at the end of each Shuva, he also has a sign-off, okay? And it's not sincerely yours, it's best regards, okay? In specific, right, it's V'Hashem Yisparach Barachmav Ya'ir Einenu Ba'or Torato Amen Ken Yehiratzal. Okay, and this is how every tshuva, more or less, ends. Okay, so the first thing that you think is, well, wait a minute, okay, so these must be two separate people because they have two different styles of signing off. All right. Well, were you convinced by that? With the sign-offs, like, do you think it's decisive? You know, this one ends Ve'yezer Shalom, this one ends Ya'ir Einenu Ba'or Torato. You buying that? Okay.
No, because if you're going to produce a forgery, you'd want to make it a bit different than your own.
Okay, I assume you wanted to say the same thing. That's exactly right. I mean, if, in fact, this is written by the Ben Ish Chai, he obviously is going to some pains here to not have us think that it was the Ben Ish Chai, right? So, clearly, it would not take very much effort to just change the sign-off from sincerely yours to best regards, right? That's the easiest thing in the world to do. Okay. Well, what do the experts think? Okay, so let's look at the Shut Ateres Paz at the bottom of the page here. Ateres Paz is Chuvas written by a contemporary, right? His name is Pinchas Zvichi. He's one of the important poskim. And he has a little, in one of his Chuvas, he writes, you know, people have been wondering about, you know, who in fact is the author of Torah Lishma, right? So he says, Hina inyan ze mihu harava mechaber et shu Torah Lishma itbe akule upshure tuva dehina yedideinu agar. He says there are lots of possibilities, right? He says, because, for example, Yedidenu Hagon Hamuvhak Mahari Sofer Shlita Svirale Kichibur Zeh Shel Shu Torah Lishma Harehu L'Hagon Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zal Gufe. Right? He says, Rab Sofer, he believes that this, in fact, was written by the Ben Ish Chai himself. Right? Rabbi Yosef Chaim, he says, that's his opinion. Okay? All right. And then he says, but Mareinu Rabbeinu Maran Malka Shlita, which I'm told when he says Maran Malka Shlita, he's referring to Rav Ovadia Yosef, right? This is when Rav Ovadia was alive, right? So he says, Agav Shitva Hodienu Mareinu Rabbeinu Shlita Dato Das Elyon Kinira Darava Mechaber Shutar Al Shma Eino Hagaon Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zatzal. So he says, Rav Sofer says that it is the Ben Ish Chai. The Torah Lishma was written by Ben Ish Chai. He says Rav Ovadia Yosef says the Torah Lishma was not written by the Ben Ish Chai. And then he concludes at the end, right? He says, Yesh makom litzaded lechan ulechan. He says, I don't know. It could go either way. Okay. Now in the little piece between here that I skipped, and this goes back to the point that you raised just a minute ago. He says, well, you know, if we look at the tshuvas themselves and we see, right, you know, what he actually says in these tshuvas, just, you know, the content, well, the content would lead us to believe, you know, one way or the other. There are certain steeris between, you know, tshuva where he answered one way in the Torah Lishma, another way in Rav Pa'olim, so that's a reason to believe it's different authors, but on the other hand, there's overlap, so that's a reason to believe it's, they're the same author. Okay, so this is a great problem, right? I've got plenty of material to work with. let's see if we can do a computer analysis and figure out whether it's the same author or not the same author. Okay. So, how would we do this? Okay. How would we do it? So, let me suggest one way that is not going to be good enough, but let's take it as a starting point. Okay. Here's what I'm going to do. I want to see whether there are real differences between these two works, between Rav Palem and Torah Lishma. Okay. So, I'm going to put them into the computer. I'm going to say to the computer, well, could you find differences in terms of word usage between the two sets, right? So, I put it in the computer, and in fact, comes back and shows me all kinds of differences between them. Okay? Well, are we convinced by that? We should not be convinced by that. And the reason we shouldn't be convinced by that is that if I took two books written by the same author and put them in, there would be all kinds of differences between them. Okay? Between any two books, there are differences, right? If I took two books by Herman Melville, and you stick them into the computer and I say, is there any difference between them? Well, yes. One of them is about a whale, okay? The other one is not about a whale, all right? So the word whale, dead giveaway, right? Moby Dick is the whale one. Yeah.
Is the algorithm or computer, is it enough to look at, like, writing style? Not, like, thematic things, just, like, the style of writing. Usually, in the virtue, like, he explains the question longer and it's...
All right, so we do have tools that could use things as like syntax and morphology and sentence length and word length and all that kind of stuff. But that's not where the action is, okay? As I said before, most of the action is in the words anyway, okay? The problem is, yeah?
How about anachronisms? So you said there's 150-year difference.
Right.
So if there were any words that came up in the 150-year-old one that do not actually...
Yeah, right. That would be a good thing to do. I haven't tried that yet. But now that I have my dictionary of words and I know every word when it began, that would be a great thing to do. Matter of fact, such a good idea, I'm going to do it tomorrow. So that's a great idea. Okay. Now, I'm not convinced by this because, as I said, there's always differences between books. But why don't we try the following trick, okay? Here's what I'm going to do. Let's say I have 500 tshuvas of Rav Ha'olam and 500 of Torah Lishma, right? Just to find differences is unpersuasive. But here's a standard trick in the field. Let's take 100 of the ones from Rav Ha'olam and 100 of the ones from Torah Lishma. Take them out of the thing. I'm going to stick them in my pocket, okay? I've got 100 in my pocket, Rav Ha'olam, 100 Torah Lishma. Now I have 400 and 400 to work with, all right? Now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to find all the differences between the 400 and the 400. I'm going to build a model that is able to say, using the point scheme I talked to you, right, I described before, I'm going to build a model, and what it's going to be able to do is, given a tshuva that's not in my collection that I trained on, it's going to be able to tell me whether or not it's Rav Palem or Torah Lishma. Okay? And how am I going to test it? I'm going to take these 200 tshuvas that I have in my pocket, and I'm going to put them into the model, and the model's going to tell me, that's Rav Palem, that's Torah Lishma, that's Rav Palem, that's Torah Lishma. And then I'm just going to check whether it worked or not, right? If it's able to tell me the difference between them, right, if it really knows, then I know that these differences aren't just random differences. These are real differences, right? Because I'm able to actually classify new works on that basis and do it right. Okay, so I did this. Okay, and I took the 200 tshuvas out of my pocket and I put it into the model and I said, do you get it right? Well, what percentage do you think it got right? Okay, so you would say, yeah, I'm 50-50, and that's right, slam dunk, this is right by the same person. There's just no difference between them, right? Or you might say, well, 100% because I think that these are by two different people, right? Okay, so the answer is it got 100% right, okay? It actually nailed them completely, 100% right. So now at this point you're thinking, okay, well, in that case, there are real differences between these tshuvas. Surely, they must be by two different authors. Think again. Let me remind you the business about the Hayezer Shalom and the Ya'ir Einenu Ba'or Torah To. Bearing that in mind, right, what could you tell me about the flaw in my methodology? Yeah?
Well, rather than you looking at the differences and saying, oh, there are differences, the computer's just done exactly the same thing and told you what you already know.
No, but the interesting part was that it was able to look at new tshuvas that it wasn't trained on, and those differences are consistent, which means that those are not random differences, those are real differences, they're consistent.
That he's put in to the work.
That's so correct. Yeah. Okay, so but that's the critical point. The critical point is exactly, you wanted to say that, did I just say anything? Okay, the point is that the moment that he did this clever thing with the if it's indeed him, he puts in Veheyezer Shalom in one and Yair Einenu Ba'or Torato, well, the computer is going to seize exactly on that, right? What it's going to do is going to say, wait a minute, I know, I got it, I looked at these 800 Shubas and I figured something out, right? If it says Veheyezer Shalom, it's Torah Lishma. If it says Yair Einenu Ba'or Torato, then it's Rav Palem, right? That's easy, okay, and it gets it right 100% of the time, based on nothing but that. Okay, so, that's a problem. How are we going to overcome this?
Sure.
Yeah?
Pretty much avoid it.
Yes.
That's a suggestion.
Okay, so I'm going to throw out those words, right? Okay, but what am I going to do then? So, the suggestion is as follows. All right, we know that Ve'yezeh Shalom and Yair Einenu Ba'or Torato are like smoking guns. They're dead giveaways, but we're not persuaded by that. So we're going to take those words out of the game, and we're going to rerun the whole experiment without those words. Okay? And now we'll see if there's still a difference. Okay? Okay. So, are you persuaded by that? Let's say I did it again, and I still got 100%. Why are you not persuaded? There might be another thing, exactly. Okay, so the answer is because there might be another thing. I mean, I happen to point out Ve'yezer Shalom and Yair Einenu Ba'or Torato, right? Okay, but I don't know, maybe he starts every tshuva with hello, how do you do in one of them, and you know, dear whatever, right, in the other one, right? I mean, okay, no guarantee that this is the only trick up his sleeve. Okay. So here's what we're going to do, right? We're going to settle this once and for all, okay? I'm not going to do this a second time and then have you complain again, all right? So we're going to do the following. Anytime, all right, here, standard computer's trick, right? Anytime you do something twice, just do it in a loop, okay? So it goes like this. What we're going to do is we're going to run the experiment exactly the way I described it to you before. Look at all the words, build a model, check whether it categorizes correctly all the stuff that I kept in my pocket. Fine. Now, we're going to say, what are the words that were the most important, right? If we're talking about the points that I told you, what are the words that get the most points, right? They're the best markers of one or the other, right? I'm going to take those, let's say, the three strongest Rav Pa'olam words and the three strongest Torah Lishma words, and I'm going to throw them out, okay? And then I'm going to do the whole experiment again without them. And what's going to happen? Well, probably my accuracy in classifying new dye will go down a little bit because they threw out valuable information. But I don't know how much it'll go down. Now let's do it again. I'm going to take the next three strongest words on each side and throw them out. And I'm going to do the experiment and measure my accuracy. And I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again. I'm doing it. I'm in a loop. I'm just keep going. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Okay, if I just keep doing this and every time I throw out the very best words for this exact experiment, my accuracy is bound to go down. But here's the miracle that happens. Okay, the miracle that happens is this. I did this on, I took pairs of books. Okay, lots of them. Lots and lots of pairs of books. Okay, sometimes they were by the same author. Just two different books by the same author. And sometimes they were two books by two different authors. And I did this whole thing. And here's what happens every single time without fail. If you take two books that are by the same author, well, if you do what I just described, you throw out the best words, the accuracy goes down, right? It's the same author now. The accuracy goes down from 100 to 97. You throw out the next best words, the accuracy goes down from 97 to 90, okay? The numbers are just made up. They vary from experiment to experiment. You keep doing this. After about 10 rounds of throwing out all the best words for distinguishing, remember, these are two books by the same author. After 10 rounds of this, all of the stuff that, you know, the word whale and the Veheza Shalom and all of that stuff, it's all gone by then. After 10 rounds of this, what you have are two books by the same author who has the same style in both books, and they become indistinguishable. After 10 rounds, I'm down to 50%. It's just random garbage, right? But if I take two books by two different authors, okay, and the two different authors could be very similar. I'm not talking about, you know, comparing, right, you know, Shakespeare to, you know, some contemporary trash novelist. Take the Bronte sisters, okay? I mean, two people that really write kind of look the same, right? You do this, you throw out some words, you go from 100 to 99, you throw out some more words and the accuracy goes down to 98. You keep doing this, after 10 rounds, you could still distinguish them with accuracy like 85%. Why? Because they're really different, right? Different authors really have different styles. And even if you throw out all of the whales and the Hayezer Shaloms, you could still tell the difference between them. Okay, so now that we know this, now we can apply this to Rav Lishma and Rav Pa'alim. And lo and behold, when you take Rav Pa'alim and Rav Lishma and you do this whole experiment, it turns out that very quickly you can't tell the difference between them. Okay? After you get rid of Eyezer Shalom and a few other things, they look exactly the same. That's because Rav Pa'alim and Rav Lishma were written by the same person, the Ben Ish Chai. Okay? And you're now thinking, why would he do that? That's just bizarre, right? I mean, especially since he quotes himself, right? I mean, he quotes himself as if he's another person. So I have no answer to that question. I've asked myself that question many times. I have no idea why he did it, okay? But what I can tell you, which I discovered after doing this whole analysis, and this absolutely nails the matter, okay? He really liked gematrias, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Baghdad, okay? And he gave us a clue. The name Yosef in gematria is exactly the same as Yechezkel, and the name Chaim in gematria is exactly the same as Kachli, okay? So Yechezkel Kachli is Yosef Chaim Baghdad. Yeah.
Maybe he didn't want to disrespect the author back then, but maybe there's someone he thought that they wrote a forgery or, you know, vice versa, and wants you to, like, figure it out using this code and looking through the gematria to find names.
Your guess is as good as mine, is all I can say. I have no idea. One thing I do know is that if he did write it, and I think he did, he wrote it when he was young, right? He was very young. So I can understand why he would not, you know, maybe stand completely behind the book, because he wrote it when he was youthful. You know, it was a youthful work and he didn't want to stand behind it. But why he would then quote it is kind of, I don't know, just flat out strange. Okay, questions? I'm done. Anybody have, yeah?
On the first story you spoke about with the Balatanya and the forgeries.
Yeah.
Surely that is just evidence of a bad forgery. Could someone technically, if we're using that methodology to test, basically just study all the, like, the letters of someone and then try and, yeah, essentially copy their writing style and therefore...
Yeah, okay, so it's very hard to do. It's hard to do that. In other words, if you try to do it consciously, you'd probably mess up because you need to get, like, you know, the frequency of little function words like ki, asher, and all those, right? And it's hard to do. But nowadays, there's some fantastic technology coming out of the deep learning community, machine learning, where you feed in hundreds of millions of words into this program, right? And it kind of learns the patterns and it spits it out, okay? It actually creates writing in a particular style. And if you look at it, you will be completely convinced by this, right? It actually looks like, you know, if you take Shakespeare and you plug it in, it looks like Shakespeare. If you take any work and you put it into this program and spit it out, there's only one problem. At this stage, it's still nonsense, okay? In other words, there's no logic to it. You're just kind of copying patterns of speech. The words are words. The sentences are sentences. I mean, it's amazing how It gets syntax and morphology right. If anybody would recognize who the author is if they know the writings of that author, but it's just kind of nonsensical. And even that is improving. And the latest program, GPT-2, is like amazingly accurate. Just for fun, I did this on the writings of Rav Kook using earlier technology. I did this about 15 years ago, before the new deep learning methods came out. And I actually put up on a website, it's called Hakovitz Hachi'i. You could Google it and find it. I turned it into a game so that there are four texts, one of which is actually taken from the writings of Rav Kook, and the other three are fake writings of Rav Kook generated by computer. And the idea is you have to guess which one is authentic and which isn't, okay? So if you can't, that means you don't really understand Rav Kook very well, right? Because you could be fooled by a text generator. Turns out most people are fooled. Your idea is correct. It's just it shouldn't be done manually. It has to be done automatically. Any other questions? Yeah.
Haven't they already done?
That was using
Dumber methods. I think it's a Markov chain or
something. That was just Markov chains.
So what's the?
It's actually context-free grammars. That one uses context-free grammars. That was very simplistic. That's the kind of trick that I use. The newer stuff is much, much, much more sophisticated. It uses essentially LSTM, which learns from sequences what the next item in the sequence should be, and it just does that on letters and words. Yeah.
With regards to luck, do we need a multiply valid proof for Hosking? If we found a source that said the psak of someone was such and such, would that be valid?
So there's many different opinions about that, stuff that we find, and so the Chazon Ish, for example, who was very felt very strongly that the Mesorah develops in a particular way for good reasons. So when various Svarim, Rishonim were found later, he said, well, I don't care. They found the Me'iri, right? So nowadays everybody learns the Me'iri. The Me'iri was unknown until, just a few decades ago. So he said, I'm not interested in learning the Me'iri, and even if the Me'iri tells me something that, because the kind of the Mesorah developed the way it did, and, He doesn't like rolling it back, So it really depends on how conservative you are about these things, whether you think things shouldn't be rolled back or not. But in terms of relying on the technology, I don't think it's any different than relying on any other scientific method that you have. I mean, DNA testing, for example, which is also controversial. So I would put it in the same category. Great. Thanks.